live from a very special episode. This is Culture Vultures with Dirk and Otto, episode number 105. Greetings, everybody. I'm your host, Dirk Belligerent, and with me tonight, not Otto the Autopilot, who is away, but an old dear friend of mine, Linda Mandolin. This is a passion project I've wanted to do for quite some time, a little bit different than we've ever done before on Culture Vultures, and I hope this works out. This is going to be a long-form interview and profile with the life, bands, and music of Linda Mandolin. We met in high school, as you'll hear, and she has gone on to a very prolific and varied musical career. We're going to try to give an overview of what she's been up to. If you're from the Detroit area, you might know her from Inside Out. If you are from the San Francisco area, you probably know her from Fabulous Disaster or Girl Band or Sassy. If you're from Portland, Maine, you might recognize her from Tiger Bomb. She's been around the world, and she's played a whole lot of music, and she's seen a million faces, and she's rocked them all. But it all started here in the Detroit area, and a power trio that I think has really kind of been forgotten, and I'm not happy about that. Inside Out formed in the mid-80s. They were an all-female power trio, and if you search for Inside Out, it's kind of a common name. You'll first find the Pixar movie. If you search with a band in the search terms, you'll get Zach De La Roca, the vocalist from Rage Against the Machine. That was his band before, and it's ironic because they had to change their name because this Inside Out had gone to Europe ahead of them. If you add Detroit to the search, you'll get a few stories, mostly about their reunion show that they did in 2012. Which we will be talking about. And this has kind of annoyed me because, well, you know, we all know the Runaways, we know the Go-Go's, and even, you know, lesser-known female bands like, you know, Throwing Muses or Belly or The Breeders or L7 or Bikini Kill or Sleater-Kinney or especially Hole. Stick around. There's a great Courtney Love story later in the show. But just to give you an overview, you know, they toured England and Europe. They were the first female band behind the former Iron Curtain after the wall fell. They did a Peel session for the BBC. You know, but it's almost impossible to get their music. Even their CD that they put out in conjunction with their reunion show is out of print and commanding $50 to $100 on eBay. Okay, so here's a chance to catch up on some of the music and hear from the woman herself, who has done quite well, except for the fact that she's not rich and famous, and this show is going to fix that. Anyway, we'll have some chat in a moment, but let's get an introduction to Inside Out. This is a song that was off of their 7 Years Bad Luck CD, which was a repackaging of a cassette that came out in 1993. And this is the kickoff track. This is Love Letter Bomb by Inside Out, Sugar Dirt. This is the Culture Vultures.
Somebody,
Love Letter Bomb by Inside Out. Okay, let's get this interview going. We'll start with the ancient history stuff, how we met. And you'll notice she occasionally slips up and calls me by my secret identity name, but we'll let it slide. So let's talk about how we met. We were in mixed choir. Mixed choir, 1984, I believe we met, right?
Yes.
Listen, when we discuss the history, people are going to be able to add up, you know? They're going to figure, well, she started it when she was 5, so she has to be at least
this 20. Many?
This many. I'm waving this my many. Fingers around. Okay, so anyway, we met in high school, 1984, so I was that was my first junior, or my first senior year, and you were junior?
Probably, no, I was sophomore, I think.
Oh, were you?
Yeah.
Okay.
I was a freshman, I think, in 83, and then, mixed choir, 84.
When did you graduate, 87 or 5, or 6?
86, I graduated to you early.
Oh, check you out.
So I could get out.
Okay. Well, lucky you. I didn't.
Aw.
Well, hey. Okay, so you sat behind me. You were in the alto section. I was in the bass section. And I just remember, I have to say, it's like, she's got spiky hair like Kathy Valentine. And she seems, did you have a go-go shirt or something? Is that how we struck up a conversation?
I think so.
So it was our mutual admiration for the go-go's at the time.
Yes. Absolutely. And I know that I would go into salons and get my hair done specifically like Kathy Valentine from the vacation. What was it? The vacation tour program from that tour.
Did you actually take that in?
Yeah, I did. I got her striped shirt, black pants, everything.
Though we had a connection with the pop concert and the mixed choir, we jammed a few times, just, partied with some friends and whatnot, but nothing really serious came about it. So let's move on now. What were her first influences that really sparked that musical fire?
Oh, my God. The Beatles, when I was little. You mean going back that far?
Sure. What was your introduction to music? Who introduced you to music?
My brothers. Okay. Yeah, my brothers. And I remember, being little, looking at a TV guide going, I was, three, probably. I'm like, who is this? And my brother Ted said, oh, it's the Beatles. And I'm like, who's in the Beatles? He's like, well, there's John Lennon and Paul McCartney. And I remember, taking the cover of the TV guide and, putting it on my wall. Okay. I just, that was, my first.
And how old were you?
3 or 4.
Really?
Yeah. Little.
So the Beatles were your first pinups then at 3 or 4.
Yeah.
Precocious.
Beatles and Monkees.
Okay.
But they were after, that was after my time,
Okay.
Before my time, sorry. Duh.
Okay, so that was your first introduction to music. Now, did you just know them by their looks or their music? And could you relate them to anything?
I knew them by, both looks and music. I think the first thing was looks at first and then music. But John Lennon was my first love. I saw his picture on the back of the Beatles' second album, and I'm like, and ever since then, every man I've met.
You were
4? Yes. And wow. I bought Meet the Beatles when I was 4 at Corvette.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah.
You had money when you were 4?
From somebody.
I didn't have, what? Is this another story we can't tell?
No, come on.
Okay, so you're a young Beatlemaniac.
Yeah.
And
baby Beatlemaniac.
So when did that turn into I want a guitar, I want a bass. What'd you start with?
With guitar. And my mom got me a Magnum electric guitar, I think, when I was 12. And then she got me my first practice amp, I think, from Royal Music in Royal Oak. Before I met you in high school, I hung out with a girl named Sally Still. I'll be real quick. Okay. She was an excellent bass player, and she had me over to her house. She played for me. She blew me away. I'm just like, wow, this is what I want to do. And she told me, Linda, you're not that good. You might need guitar lessons. I'm like, yeah, you're right. So I started taking guitar lessons at Music Castle from Joe Mazzola.
From Sponge.
From Sponge.
And I took lessons from him, too. Small world.
Yeah, but I didn't take him for that long. I took it for 3 or 4 months just to get the basics. And then by the time I was 15, I was writing my own stuff.
I didn't. I think I did it for about a year.
Okay.
Nothing major. Mm-hmm. Learned some songs, and it's kind of clicked me from there.
Right.
Okay. So you have your little Magnum guitar. My first electric guitar was a Magnum too.
Yeah.
I think everybody in the around 1980, early 80s got a Magnum first guitar.
I think so too. Oh, so, okay. I wanted to add one more thing. When I first saw the Go-Go's on Saturday Night Live, that was a pinnacle for me, and it changed my life because it was women, all women, that wrote their own songs and played their own instruments.
Okay, we're gonna. I want to come back to that about the Go-Go's and influences, but I want to work my way through. So
okay.
So anyway, you get a guitar and you're starting to write music like when you're 15.
Yep.
Who are your influences? I forgot to ask you that last time.
At that point, well, the Go-Go's, Beatles, Monkees. I was just getting into the new wave.
But like any particular guitarist, or you're like, oh, I want to play like him, like, you know. For guys, it was Eddie Van Halen or Angus Young or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. At that point, as a teen, I really loved Johnny Marr from the Smiths.
Okay.
Will Sargent from Echo and the Bunnymen was a big influence. George Harrison, of course. But those early new wave guys, you know, English guys, were really big influences on me.
All right. How so?
I don't know. I like their approach. I like their style. I like their effects. They were melodic. Johnny Marr had like some great, you know, leady, melodic, kind of complicated, you know, riffs that he'd play. I wasn't really like, I wasn't into Van Halen or anything like that. Oh, Gang of Four. Okay. I was really influenced by Gang of Four and their kind of rigid, you know, kind of structured.
That slashy guitar.
Yeah.
Slashing angular guitar.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of slappy. I like it.
Okay. So, back to the Go-Go's now and seeing them in SNL. I remember seeing them too.
Did you see that episode?
Yeah. Yeah.
And Jane Fonda hosted, I think.
I can't remember who hosted it. I just remember going, wow, the drummer's cute. Quick interruption for a fact check. The host of that show was Bernadette Peters. And there was a second musical guest on that one, Billy Joel. This was on November 14th, 1981. That was season 7, episode 6, for those of you who are keeping score, you know?
Yeah.
And they came out and they did Our Lips Are Sealed and We Got the Beat.
Yeah.
And I just remember, you know, it's like, I was just like, I thought, oh, this is cool. This is pop music and they were cute, you know, and stuff like that. But, you know, for you as a budding musician, how did that flip your switch?
Well, especially being a girl, I hadn't seen anything like that before. I really didn't grow up with the Runaways. I didn't really grow up with any female musician, influences. I loved, like R&B and soul, like singers, but, any female bands per se? No. So when I saw them on TV, I'm like, wow, this is what I'm going to do.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of like how, you know, turntable is, scratch DJs. When they saw Herbie Hancock on the Grammy Awards doing Rocket with Grandmaster DST, they're like, you can do that? I want to do that.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Okay.
Exactly right.
All right. So, you know, so you're in the influenced by Go-Go's camp, not the influenced by Runaways camp.
Right.
At this point, Joan Jett was solo. And there were starting. And then a little bit later, we started getting into other, like the Bangles and other, basically the all, women play rock and roll. Okay. Let's get some other rock and roll bands. And, you know, eventually you get to like Vixen or like, for example, were you aware of Heart and Nancy Wilson?
More so in the '80s, like maybe later Heart. I kind of missed the '70s thing because I think I was too young.
Okay.
But, you know, looking back on them now, I worship them. I think they're awesome. You know, they're great. And they're such a force, you know, but back when I was a kid, yeah, like I guess I got a taste of the '80s kind of mediocre Heart.
The pop stuff that sold, and they made Nancy the front person because she's the hot babe,
the hot
right?
one. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Well, that's the way it goes.
And big hair.
Hey, man, it was the '80s.
I know.
You look at the pictures, it's like, my God, shoulder pads. Okay.
Metal hair.
Metal hair. So, Karen Neal, Queen Bee.
Queen Bee.
Yeah, Marcy Rah-Rahs, Karen Neal, bassist of Inside Out. How did that happen?
Well, I think I just turned 16. I put an ad in the Metro Times.
So we're talking 1984?
No, late 85.
Late 85.
Okay. Or maybe summer of 85. Yeah, summer of 85.
Okay.
And, I put an ad in, the Metro Times looking for a bass player. Okay. And I was already jamming with my childhood friend and neighbor, Chrissy Charnoskis, who, you know, was influenced also by the Go-Go's and all the 80s cool bands and stuff. And she always loved the drums. So she bought a drum kit and we started jamming together. We're like, wow, we need a bass player.
And even though it's irrelevant, the thing about Chrissy that always blew my mind is how tall and how long her legs were. Basically, she'd be Taylor Swift nowadays.
Oh, yeah.
Nowadays, she would be Taylor Swift. That's what she looked like.
A little bit, but so, dark hair.
Okay.
And her dad was, you know, her parents were Christian and stuff. And I don't think that they were real crazy about her being a drummer, musician, per se.
Sure.
So when we got Karen, you know, we had, a couple strong personalities, Karen and myself. And when we first got together and gelled, Karen came to the door and she had, you know, bloody hand earrings hanging from her ears. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm in love. And so she came up, you know,
in a totally straight rock and roll way.
Yeah.
Not that there's
big
anything
hair,
wrong with that.
Yeah. We both had big hair. And we just clicked like automatically. It's like, wow, this is who I've been waiting for, you know? So we jammed some covers and, you know, we started jamming some original material, you know,
and you were playing guitar and she was playing bass.
Yeah.
Okay.
And at that time though, I was like, you know, I remember borrowing my neighbor's bass and playing bass, but she already had a bass. She had an amp. So I'm like, yeah, I'll switch back to guitar too. So, you know, she was on bass. I was playing guitar, Chrissy on drums. And then we met a girl named Therese, who was from Ferndale, and she had a Juno 106. So,
oh my God, I knew her. I remember her.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. And so she joined the band, too, and so we played our first show in November 85 at the Falcon Lounge.
Where was that at?
8 Mile and Van Dyke. It was a shithole. And the neighborhood, Peter, was so bad. And so, like, all our folks came and stuff, and we opened for Angry Rib Planet and a metal band called Ugly But Proud. So it was our first gig.
Was Ugly But Proud considered metal? I thought they were punk.
No way. No, okay. they have some way metal qualities. Yeah.
Way metal.
Way metal. Super nice guys. And it was packed. And our first show, we made $200. We're like, oh my God, we are into something good. Holy shit, this is the best.
Oh my God. You didn't realize that. How long did it take you to realize that? No, it's not always going to be this way.
The second gig. Well, we made $26.
Still more than some yes. shows we've played.
Yes. And our car broke down. And our car broke down in front of a strip club. Anyway. So, but anyway, that first gig, we played the show, we're on a high. I got 10 drink tickets. I was 16 years old. The drummer's dad.
And the drinking age was 21 then, right?
Yes.
Yeah, they had just jacked it up somewhere. Like, some of them were in high school, it's like, we're counting it down, and it's like, no. It's like, thanks. Not that it's going to stop us. But, right. Okay.
Yep, it was 21.
So you got 10 drink tickets.
Yes.
Did they know how young you were?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I looked pretty young. I looked like Robert Smith. So after the show, our drummer, Chrissy's dad, came up and he told her, you're never playing another shithole again. That was the end of her drumming career. She had to quit.
Well, after this brief taste of the rock life, Chrissy would never play in a band again. By the way, quick fact check here. The drinking age was raised from 18 to 21 in Michigan in 1985, the year I was going to turn 18. So thanks. But fortunately for Detroiters, the drinking age in Kentucky across the river was 19. So if anyone out there remembers Mother's Pizza, they were a Canadian chain. They went under in the late 80s, I think, but they had really good pizza to go with the low drinking age. In fact, one time some friends and I went to Windsor for pizza and underage drinking, and 2/3 of our bill was the bar tab. But anyway, back to Linda's story now. So anyway, after Chrissy was yanked from the band, they did a second show with a fill-in male drummer. Teresa, the keyboardist, left, and it was just Linda and Karen when Damian Lang of Snake Out had a referral for them.
Kathy Carroll. And I remember exactly where I was. I was in Berkeley at a party, and he's like, I know this girl. Oh my God, she's so awesome. She would fit your band perfectly. And so I think we called her up. I talked to her, and I'm like, oh yeah, how old are you? 21. Oh, you can buy beer. You're in.
And if you've got a van or a PA, you're totally.
Yeah. So she came over and jammed and just blew our minds. I mean, I'm just like, what the hell? This is like the best.
So you have this powerhouse drummer and so you got the three piece. Now
I've got three piece.
And
yep.
so it pretty much clicked immediately.
Absolutely. Oh my God.
You didn't have to go through 100 different musicians. You basically found a bassist and did a gig, and then you found a drummer and you did a gig, and then boom, that was the arrangement.
It fell in our lap.
That
yeah.
was very serendipitous.
Yes. It was meant to be.
Mm-hmm. So now you're the trio, right?
Uh-huh. Yep. Explain. That was around, yeah, that was around February 86. I think we played our first show at Hamtramck Pub in February of 86 as a three-piece.
Okay.
And we continued playing shows, you know, in the Detroit area. We played with the Gories, Beer on the Penguin, just Beer on the Penis. Orange Ruffies, you know, like all those like late 80s, you know, great new wavy.
The Hamtramck kinda, bands.
Yeah, the Hamtramck
bands.
You know,
bands. That Paychecks, Hamtramck Pub, Lilies, you know, Axes.
Yeah.
Okay, so how did you guys, you know, explain the, how, like, your music creation process? Who, is there, was it a jamming based thing? Did people come in with songs?
It could
who,
be.
Yep. Who did what?
Yeah, we did a lot of jamming. We would take, you know, parts of jams, put them together. Sometimes Karen would come in with a full song with even guitar parts. Sometimes I would come in with a full song, you know, with lyrics, you know, ready to go. One time there's a song called Dead Children on our EP called Do It Yourself Nose Job that those two jammed in Kathy's basement while I think I was here. I can't remember. And they came up with the music and I came up with the lyrics. So it was like, you know, a collaborative.
So it was very organic, collaborative, yeah. You know, just someone brings in a piece that's needed and it all gets bolted together. Do you guys share the songwriting credit?
Oh, yeah.
So it was
mostly
always, was it
Karen, always a, and, Karen and myself.
Was it always a three-way split or is it the people who actually wrote those songs?
Pretty much the people that wrote those songs.
Okay. So yeah. If it was a you and Karen song, it'd be that and Kathy would be out. And if something they came up with, okay. Right. Well, no, I mean, some bands like, you know, Van Halen would be Eddie and the singer, and then, you know, the other guys would be credited, but they didn't do anything.
Right, right. I think our thing like, was...
And Lennon and McCartney, you know, yeah. There's the Lennon songs and the McCartney songs, but they both took credit.
Sure. Yeah. So, yep. Yeah, it was like that.
I interrupted your thought, did you?
No.
Okay.
It's okay. I think, you know, I guess whoever wrote the guitar part or... You know, Kathy wrote some great drums, you know, okay. Like drum lines and everything. But I think we kind of went by like who wrote what, like guitar, like the music, you know.
So how did you guys decide on the direction sonic wise, lyrically wise? I mean, you know,
I have no clue. I mean, it came together so organically. We didn't even have words for it. You know, like we're like, oh, wow, this part's really cool. Okay, this is the Cleopatra part. Oh, and like if someone influenced us that week, okay, like this is the Fugazi part, you know, like it was just really a mishmash of ideas and coming from like such young minds, you know, I don't know. It's hard to describe, you know, it's just, it happened.
Okay.
I don't know.
No, fair enough. No, I mean, but so you guys had a really like a, you know, a psychic hive mind connection and stuff like this. But
yes,
but
I mean, very close.
I'm just saying that it's like, you know, but were there any sort of themes that you were trying to explore lyrically? Were you trying to be a party band, a punk band, a mm-mm. rock band, a political
kind of serious.
Band, a,
no know, political, no,
but just, you know, but how would you describe, you know, the genre? How would you describe yourself musically? What category would you file yourself under?
Oh my God. Pop, prog, thrash, jazz, punk. You know, it ran the gamut. I mean, you can hear all these different influences in our songs, you know, like we'd have a pop song, we'd have a thrash hardcore song, we'd have more of a punky song. We'd have like more of a sad, you know, love song, punky song, a prog rock song like Mind to Forget. It like has this like yes breakdown. It's like, where did that come from? But
well, I used to always describe you guys as like if Rush were chicks and punkier.
Okay.
Because you guys were phenomenal musicians.
Yeah.
And,
thank you.
And when we get up to your reunion show, we'll discuss that in a moment. Mm-hmm. So. Anyhow, all right, so you're playing around. Mm-hmm. How's the following going? When do you start getting attention? When do you start thinking about recording?
We started getting attention probably around 88, 89. We were pretty close to selling out Paychecks a lot. I mean, a lot of people, there was a big buzz about us.
Okay.
And this is back in the days where you could send a cassette tape out to different magazines, get reviews, and get... interest. Hence, our really good review in Maximum Rock and Roll that got us signed to Meantime Records in England in 1990.
Okay.
Or actually 89, I'm sorry.
Okay. Okay, this would probably be a good time to hear a couple tracks off of that Meantime Records release. This is 1990's Take You Apart, Put You Back Together, and we're going to kick things off with Click Set Click. We are the Culture Vultures special feature interview with Linda Mandolin.
Click me out.
That's Take Away the Pain by Inside Out off their Take You Apart, Put You Back Together album. And before that, Click Set Click from the same album from 1990 on Meantain Records. Okay, let's see what happens next.
So you get a review, Maximum Rock and Roll.
Mm-hmm.
And that gets you interested for Meantime. So what's Meantime about?
Meantime was a more of a punk independent label based out of Darlington, England, which is northern England. He had released a lot of stuff, you know, more punky bands like from England, but he really liked the review and who the writer compared us to. He compared us to the Rhythm Pigs, who were a three-piece from San Francisco who were very, very much like us. You know, they had the Rush kind of quality, but, you know, backed with, you know, more of a hardcore, you know, fast, Minutemen-like approach, I guess. And he wanted to hear more, so we sent him that cassette tape, and, you know, more stuff. We went.
What did it cost to mail a tape to England?
I can't remember. I don't know.
That's all.
Yeah, maybe.
But the thing is, you would have to send it off, and you wouldn't hear anything for a week or two.
He'd probably write us back or call us, you know. So this is like before email, people.
This is so quaint.
I know. So we went into a studio in 1989 in Warren. I can't remember the name of the studio. And we recorded our first album for Meantime called Take You Apart, Put You Back Together.
Now, you had done Do It Yourself, No Job. That was your first release?
No. Take You Apart was. Take You Apart.
So that was your very first record. You didn't have any singles. You didn't have done anything before. So this is your first thing. So Take You Apart. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we recorded with a guy, I think his name was Kevin Holliver, and he was based out of Warren, Michigan. A friend of ours kind of hipped us to him. He had a nice studio, and he actually had a DAT machine, which he had just got on the black market, and we're like, DAT, what's that? So we went in there. We were kind of disappointed with the quality. I mean, it was okay, but like when it went to mastering, He cut like a couple of like the beginnings of some of the songs off and just
in the mastering process. He did that when he was recording.
I think in the mixing.
Whoa.
I know.
How does that happen?
I know. It's like you can. I mean, if you're us, you can tell, but I don't think the general public knew. But we got it mastered in England, so like, you know, we got the record back and we were kind of like, it was kind of lacklusterous. But, I mean, it was kind of neat to have, you know, a tour planned and my first album in my hands at age 20. I was going to Europe, you know, and it was a really exciting time. And, you know, and Ami wanted to interview us.
Now, had you toured anywhere in America?
We had played in 1988 at the Pyramid Club in New York. And I had just turned 18. We were so excited. It was like our first kind of road trip, you know, and we had played like Toledo and Youngstown, Ohio, which was a hot spot. And I think Columbus, you know, places like that. I think we played Chicago a couple times, but
you weren't road warriors, couch surfing or anything like that. You just basically would hit and run, do a show.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We all worked and stuff and so pretty young.
So you pack up and you go to England. What happens there?
It was great. When we first got there, they didn't believe our story. We had to lie and say that, fib.
Who didn't believe your story?
The airport people, the customs people.
Customs people.
Yeah. So I came in with a leather jacket. What do you do for work? Oh, I'm, you know, a preschool teacher. Yeah, sure. Over there.
This is pre-terrorism or TSA,
yeah.
So you must have been really shady if they were looking at you.
I guess so. But I think at the time, our label guy, he was too late on getting work papers or he didn't get them. I can't remember. But so we had to tell the story that we were coming over there just to record. If we would have said we were going to play, they would deport us because we'd be making money. And it wasn't being reported, you know?
I know all about getting caught at the border.
Yeah. So they like interrogated us, like took us into, you know, separate rooms. We're like shit in our pants. We're like, oh my God. And they're like, she said this, she said that. Blah, blah, blah. But like we stuck to our story and they basically told us, well, if you get caught, you know, playing over here, you're going to be deported. So they let us go and thus began our first tour. It was about 2.5 months.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Of just Europe or just England?
A lot of England, maybe 5 weeks in the UK. We played everywhere.
How do you fill everywhere. A 5 week tour in UK? Because UK's not that big.
I know, but there's a lot of small towns.
Really?
Exeter, Scunthorpe. I've played that 3 times. I'm not proud.
okay, why not? What is this town called?
Scunthorpe. We call it Scumthorpe or Scunny. It's like the armpit of England. I mean, it's...
What's it like? Compare it to something in America that we can relate to.
Zug Island? I don't know. Gary, Indiana?
Wow.
I mean, like, it's bad. It's bad.
Is it like a Birmingham industrial town? Or,
oh, God. Oh, Birmingham's way better. Yeah. No, Scunthorpe is nothing. I mean, I hate to say that because I did have a boyfriend from Scunthorpe. But, you know, it's... I don't know. It was just nothing. Okay. And even the people that live there hated it. So, like, it's like... like the Rouge River, you
right
know?
With you.
Can't, yeah. You can't wash it off.
So, okay. So, you're over there for that long? Were you planning on being that long?
Two and a half months.
So, you knew you were going over for 2.5 months?
Yes. Yes. And
did you guys have jobs to come back to?
We skipped around.
Young, so.
Yeah, we were pretty young. But when we came over the first time in 1990... we had some press interest, and we actually were quoted by Thurston Moore as being the first wave of Foxcore bands. Foxcore.
Before Riot Girl was Foxcore.
Foxcore, which included Inside Out, a band called Wench, Hole, and L7.
Okay, the thing is that most people have heard of Hole and L7.
Yeah.
Okay, L7 all-female band, Hole, Courtney Love's band.
Yeah.
Why isn't Inside Out automatically just rolling off the tongue with those other bands?
I don't know. We were on an independent label. I don't think we were never signed to a major.
Did you ever get any sniffs from a major?
Yeah. We got sniffs from Columbia Records.
And what happened there?
We
obviously nothing, but what happened there?
We didn't want to sound like the Bangles. So we just... I don't know. We talked to a few people and like nothing. It didn't amount to anything.
Okay.
So this
is all about the base. That same time in 1990 or 91.
1990. Yeah. This is the first tour.
First tour.
Yeah.
Okay. Then what happened in 91?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the first tour was great. We had a lot of great press out of that. Like we came over and like wow, NME was there, Melody Maker. I mean, this is back in the time where. You know, actual...
They were the Rolling Stones spin of England. All right.
Yeah. And they were a paper, an actual paper, you know, you read.
Sure.
And so we got some, you know, leverage with that. And we got interest from John Peel.
The legendary BBC.
Yeah.
DJ.
In 91. And at that time, I think in early 91, we released an EP called Do Yourself Nose Job. And he got wind of that. And he really liked... You know, he really liked our style. And at that time, in 1990, we recorded, unfortunately, at a studio in Middlesbrough, England, which would become our second album, She's Lost Her Head.
Okay.
We, Karen and I, wanted to say, hey, we recorded this in England. It sounded like shit. So we brought it back to the States. Al Sutton tried to put some magic on it at the White Room Studio.
Right.
The drums sounded like popcorn.
You guys,
Triggers.
You did Triggers.
Yeah.
And this is Triggers in 1991 technology.
Yes.
Nowadays, you know, they could probably
salvage it
up a little bit.
Yes. Yeah. So, we had.
I like that record.
Thank you. Yeah. I thought the songs are great.
What the hell is this? My Misery?
Share My Misery.
Share My Misery. Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that song.
It's great.
Love it. When you guys played it at your reunion, I was like, I'm out of here. I can go home now.
It's awesome. Yeah. Yeah. It was one of my favorites too. I don't know. We put it out. It was kind of a rush. You know, we had the momentum.
Excuse me.
Coming over in 1990 with our first album. Okay. We got to follow it up. We're going to record in England. Oh, it sounds like shit. Okay. Sorry. And take it back to the States. Try to doctor it up. Oh, it's too late. We're going for another tour. The second album's out. It sounds like shit, but we tour behind that. But those songs got us the actual real Peel interest. He played songs off that album.
Even though you thought it sounded terrible.
Yes. I thought. Well, we thought it sounded terrible. So we went over 91 to support that that album. We literally went back, gosh, maybe 8-9 months later. So it was really quick. A 3.5 month tour.
Of England, or is this the European tour?
European. Now? Well, yeah. I mean, they were both European tour, a lot in England the first time. Right. But both were European, England. And we went over and recorded a Peel session. And
explain the significance of that, just how big a deal that is.
It's very big a deal. It's great. I mentioned it to people today and they're like, what? I mean, they're like either impressed or they don't know what I'm talking about. So at age 22, you know, I'm recording in the same places that, you know, so many great bands have gone before me.
Yeah. The Peel sessions were basically bands. They came and they played live in a BBC studio.
Yes.
You know, lay down the tracks, no multi-tracking, and then he would air it. And it's just, you know, it's a big deal.
Very big deal. And we even made, like, you know, his the best of in 1991, you know, like there, I found lists online that we, you know, made the cut.
And you still didn't get famous.
I know. Sort of. I mean, in certain circles, but like not like Taylor Swift famous, but I mean, we did well, you know?
Let's put it this way. It's 25 years later and people know who L7 is. They know the one song. They know Pretend We're Dead.
Yeah. Okay. And I saw L7 at Blondie's with Bad Religion and 7 people came.
Wow.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, like, you're doing month long tours. Now, when did you start going to Eastern Europe? When did that pop come in?
I think that was our first tour in 1990. We went over there right when, we were, like I said, we were the first all female punk band to go over to Eastern Berlin.
Okay. Was there an all female other genre band that had done it first? Or are we splitting it that way? Or is this the first all female rock band period that did this?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that's pretty special, you know, because the wall came down in what, 89, I think, right?
Thereabouts, yeah.
Okay. So, you know, going over there, you know, we saw all these like overturned cars, you know, we stayed in a black apartment. Everything was painted black. You know, burned out buildings.
Someone took the song extremely literally, huh?
Yeah. Burned out buildings. I mean, it was like a war zone, you know, but what a time to go over there.
But you were in Eastern Europe after the fall of the wall. So it was like, it wasn't. Okay, it was Eastern Europe, but not like Eastern Europe, you know,
right.
Cold War Eastern Europe.
It was still very new, though.
Sure.
Yeah. And you would see all the communist graffiti, you know.
All the propaganda, murals and stuff, all that, you
some
know.
Of it.
That, you know, what do they right. call it? Socialist, something,
yeah.
something art. Yeah, I know. I'm drawing a blank.
Right.
Okay. So, and how are you received? Just because you're the first Western thing, you're just basically, you know, you're automatically winning because you're just so.
They caught wind of it. I mean, like, you know,
considering that,
word of mouth.
They were locked, they were pretty locked down and.
Yeah. Know. Well, I mean, they were opened up. They love music. We played Poland in front of like 600 kids. You know, it was crazy, you know, and they just flipped because they hadn't seen anything like it. Women from America coming over and like beating the shit out of them. Come on. They loved it. It was great.
Okay.
But I remember too, like after the concert, like everything had to be over by a certain time, like 9 or 10. So it was like martial law. It's like, get the fuck off the street.
Wow.
Yeah. But it was interesting, you know, like we met so many, you know, awesome people, you know, from bookers to fans to dudes. one time we took over like, you know, a van full, like 20 dudes, like, you know, to our next party or whatever it was. I mean, it was just, you know, I don't know. It's hard to describe. It was like, it was a great feeling. It was just rad.
But it didn't last forever, did it?
No.
Okay. But before we get to the end of that era, let's take a break to hear my favorite Inside Out tune off of their 1991 She's Lost Her Head album. They may not like the production, but I think the song is still great. This is Share My Misery. We are the Culture Vultures, and this is a special episode with Linda Mandolin.
Listen,
Lost for Words, Inside Out, off of their 2012 7 Years Bad Luck CD. They also did a recording of that for the Peel session. They asked me not to include that version because it's BBC copyright property, but I have the suspicion that if you were to fire up a Google and search the Tubes of You, hint, hint, you might be able to find the rocking live version. And before that, Share My Misery, my favorite song off their She's Lost Her Head album. Okay, let's find out how this chapter of the story ends. What happened?
No. I don't know. After our second tour, you know, we came back. We had already written like a third album, you know, at that time. We were playing new songs for our third album live. And, you know, we were ready to record that. We came back. I think we recorded at White Room this time. And the recording was fabulous. I mean, it was just like the best thing we ever did. It was great. We just had a hard, and we released singles, you know, on different labels. We were, you know, still, you know, doing well locally and stuff. We didn't really get off the ground in the States. It was really hard to tour as an independent band here in the States. It's very different than touring Europe. And
also,
well, you get a lot more support in Europe. You get more better guarantees. They put you up. They feed you. They just welcome, I think, the, you know, music and the arts more, whereas, you know, you play Kalamazoo, it's like, okay, yeah, you need a place to stay, here's the floor, you know, right. Maybe you'll make $50. If you're an unknown band, it's like, it's kind of hard to do, you know, it's really difficult.
Is there a cultural difference, or is it, I would think that, like, distance-wise, just because how big America is.
Yes, very spread out. It's very vast, and, it is cultural too, because like I said, you know, it's a different world. It's, you know,
it's like a whole different bunch of countries.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're back and, you're recording and the stuff's great, but
we just, at that point it was like, you know, probably 93 or whatever. There was like some, we weren't necessarily falling apart. We were having a hard time concentrating and sticking together as, well, I mean, you know, we were still a band, but we were starting to get different interests, I think. And, you know, we had a manager at that time, and she got very frustrated with us. You know, she's like, God, you guys are so good, and you're just like, you're pissing it all away. We're like, what are you talking about? I'm drinking. Hey, what happened to my 12th beer? You know, let's jam and stuff like that. So, I don't know, like, we recorded that. We were really excited with that. Played locally. But yeah, we started to get different interests, I guess. And I started playing in a band called Loomer. I really liked the shoegaze stuff. I was really influenced by the early 90s wave of English bands coming out, like My Bloody Valentine, Chapter House, a band from America called Medicine. And Karen, you know, I think her first band outside of Inside Out was Pussyfoot, and they were more like punk rock, like punky stuff.
Okay.
Jeff, her now husband, he was in Pussyfoot. A guy named Nate from Forced Anger was in Pussyfoot. And they were great.
I've never heard of them.
Yeah.
That's weird. Okay.
Yeah. But early 90s.
About, but we're here to talk about you.
That's
so,
right.
So did you guys like officially like, you know, screw you, big fight, break up, or just kind of like just dissipate?
No, actually we stayed friends. I mean, we'd have fights like any other band, but we stayed together. We recorded at
Tim, the White Room stuff.
And yeah, we did White Room stuff. It didn't come out though. We were still kind of sitting on it, waiting for like a good label to come around, and that didn't happen. And
now, what year we're talking here? Like 93,
94.
Okay, now this is the fully engaged post grunge era. Nirvana, everything. Any guy in a flannel shirt in the Pacific Northwest got a deal, even if he was a lumberjack, okay?
Oh, yeah, we opened for Tad. I mean,
so, yeah, Tad, Soundgarden, Nirvana, Pearl Jam, you know, the Lollapalooza thing, you know, mm-hmm. Freaking Hole, okay, and
L7, the Breeders.
And once again, where are you? Basically, it's like you guys packed it in right at the moment you should have been cashing it in.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess so. I know that we had a little interest from Alternative Tentacles from Jello. I mean, he really loved the band, but he never signed us. And we had, you know, we even had interest from Scotty Brothers, who signed Survivor. Hey. I have a tiger. but nothing ever came of that. So, you know, we continued releasing stuff on small labels, playing locally. And by the time 1995 rolled around, I decided, I'm like, I'm moving to California. And we recorded our last kind of EP. It was four songs at Tim Pakladinas' Woodshed Studios.
Right.
So we recorded, stayed friends, and stayed a band right up until the point that I left.
Okay. So there wasn't like really a breakup. It's just basically mm-hmm. a, and I'm out.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
stuff is changing. Yeah.
So that's the end of Inside Out for the moment.
Yep.
Lumer. Now, it started Lumer. Here and packed up and went there.
Yeah.
You knew. So tell us about Lumer.
Yeah. Lumer, like I said, I was really influenced by the way, you know, the new wave of the 90s English shoegaze bands. A la My Bloody Valentine.
Oh, hold on a second. Wait, let me back up. Lickety Clit.
That was a project Karen and I did.
And what was that about?
Damian Lang named it.
Are you going to name your new EP Lickety Clit?
We're like, we gotta do a dance band with like bad lyrics for that. You know, we got to use that name. So we kept talking about it while we were on tour, you know, in Europe and stuff. So we came back. We recorded with our friend Hugh Cayley. He was... We each had like special names. He was the Thigh Master. I was Yoko Boner, and Karen was Lily Whiteass.
What?
Yeah.
I remember Yoko Boner. I thought she was Yoko Boner, but
no, okay. That's me. No, and I'm also
the Thigh Master. I remember he was Thigh Master.
His original name was Blue Boy Smeared Beard. Don't ask me where we got that.
I remember the smear beard thing. That's like something that was like a thing back when we were hanging out.
Yeah.
Don't know what it was about, yeah. But
Lord knows where it came from. But we just had these ideas, and it took a while, but like we, you know, we recorded on Hughes Fostex, reel to reel.
Wow.
Originally. And then we kept recording. It took a few years, like from 92 to 95. We actually finished the record in California.
Wait, were you talking about, now we're back to Lumer?
No, Lickety Clit.
Okay. So, yeah. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. And, you know, I ended up putting out the Lickety Clit album on my own label, Evil Eye Records, later from San Francisco. Okay. It actually did very well on college radio.
Did it?
Yeah.
Okay.
It did.
So you now you've packed up and you moved to San Francisco.
Yes.
What prompted this move?
Something told me to get the hell out of Detroit. I needed a change. I felt like the scene and everyone around me, it was too small, and something kept pulling me.
But why there and why not anywhere else?
Well, it could have been New York, but it didn't work. But Ginger, our keyboard player of Lumer, got a job in the Bay Area, and she's like, well, what do you think? We're like, wow, this is our chance. So we moved four of the five members out.
Wow.
California. And we pretty much sunk on impact.
What happened?
I don't know. It just fell apart. You know, like we played a few shows. They were pretty lacklusterous. I met my incredible husband, you know, like in August of 1995.
That wasn't a total waste of a relocation.
No, it was the best decision I ever made. but so... You know, and we recorded there. We did some demos. But, yeah, it kind of just imploded on impact. It was just, I don't know if it was starting over. We were.
Is that one guy you left behind?
Yeah.
That was the key member.
Yeah. No, not really. And, you know, we were a big fish. We were big fish in a little pond here. We get there, we're the small fish in the big pond. So, yeah, it ended quickly. And we just, you know, had different ideas and, you know.
Now, what happened? You guys would do some recording. I think you did one record, didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah. It's called World Tip Blue. And they were basically demos. And we also did a cassette tape while we were here in Detroit. And that was like our first 10-song, you know, release.
Okay.
And that actually sounds pretty good. It was recorded on a beta 12-track.
Right.
You know, back in the day. So we you know, moved to California. We finished the CD with Serge, who's my husband now. He became a member of Lumer after the whole fiasco. We kind of became a recording band.
Okay.
You know, we recorded.
So you weren't going to be gigging, but you would, you know, do tracks.
Right.
When did you start the label? What prompted you to just, you know, like, what did you realize? You had stuff piling up and like, I need to get this out, and the only way it's going to get out is if I do it myself?
Right. Around 97, we originally called it, Serge and I started the label Propeller Records, but we wanted, you know, more of a special name, so we, you know, chose Evil Eye. Got a really good website together, put out, Lickety Clit, Loomer.
So what year is this?
97.
Wow, you're on the really early edge of, you know, of the internet.
Yes. Okay. Oh, yeah. Yeah. In 95, like, I remember asking Hugh, can I send an email? What is it? You know, like it was so new.
Okay. To close out this first decade of Linda's music, let's listen to a couple songs, which will cover her move to the left coast, starting with Lickety Clit. This is Sweet Young Thang off of their self-titled 1998 album. We are the Culture Vultures, and this is a special episode with Linda Mandolin.
Thank you.
Well, that's certainly a change of pace. That's Lumer with Viperine from World Tip Blue from 1998. And before that, Lickety Clit, Sweet Young Thang, also from 1998. Both of those are available on Linda and Serge's Evil Eye Records. The website's still up. It's evileyerecords.com. Apparently, there's a thrash metal label called Evil Eye because creativity is dead, but they are not the .com one. If you wish to purchase any of the stuff that you're hearing, evileyerecords.com. And if you want to go to culturevulturesradio.com, I will gather all the links to the places that you want to be. All right, let's go back to the interview and see what happens next.
As you've relocated to San Francisco, you've found your soulmate and the band fell apart. What did you do then?
Well, you know, we started the label and then for some reason, I don't know why, but like something told me to check the music ads. So, and I usually don't check music ads. I start bands. I don't join them. Something told me to check.
I start bands.
I start band, my own band. I answered this one, ad from the SF Weekly. It's a, you know, it's like the Metro Times. And they were looking for a girl bass player for an all-girl band. They had label interest and they had their own rehearsal space. I'm like, wow, this is kind of cool. And they were kind of like more on the punk rock tip. And I'm like, this sounds really cool. So I went there. I checked them out. And I met one of my best friends to this day, Sally. She was the drummer. And they didn't have they had sort of a singer, but they weren't crazy on her. Or they had a falling out or whatever. And then the guitar player, I found out, wasn't a girl. It was a guy named Jimmy Crucifix. And so...
How did you miss that?
It's funny. All-girl band. I'm like, oh. And he had, like, you know, white Rod Stewart hair, pink slip-on shoes, and, like, this mesh shirt. And I'm like, wow, this guy's awesome. So, like, we jammed together. And they were the best bunch of people. And I'm just like, wow, they're friggin' amazing. And his songs were incredible. So catchy, so poppy, so
and
everything.
Band was?
Piston.
And?
So Piston put out a 7-inch single on Evil Eye Records on my label. We basically just played a lot of San Francisco shows. We were pretty local, and we kind of kicked around for 2 years. We had found Laura, our lead singer at that point, and so we were 4-piece. You know, we had a great time. We played some great shows. But the three of us, the girls, wanted to start like a side all-female band.
Okay.
How
co-ed was the band? I mean, was it three girls and a guy?
Three girls and a guy. Yes. So it was.
So you were whole was the guy as the guitar. So you were whole with Eric. So you wanted to get rid of Eric and get a girl.
Right, but yeah, but Jim.
Well, no, because there was a time during the 90s. Where bands fell into what I call the hole configuration or the Elastica configuration.
Yeah.
Hole configuration is that the lead guitarist was a guy, all the rest were girls. Elastica configuration is they were all girls except for the drummer.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Right.
So you were hole configuration.
Right, but in our case, Jimmy was the main songwriter. So he
problematic.
Wrote, yeah. So he wrote a lot of the stuff, and it was great. I wrote a few things. Sally and Laura wrote maybe one song. But we were like, well, you know, we had some ideas kicking around together that we wanted to maybe introduce in a new band or setting. And in walks Mr. Nancy. She came to the studio and she was like kind of a San Francisco fixture. She worked at a really cool club called Bottom of the Hill. We jammed together and Piston was kind of falling apart at that point, and we made Fabulous Disaster the focal point.
Okay.
And I know that.
Toss Eric out of the band. You get Mr. Nancy in the band. What's with the name Mr. Nancy?
Mr. Nancy. Mr. fucking Nancy to you. She's 4'11" and.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
She plays the SVT. I mean, she's a badass. She talks like this. So everyone thought, you know, when she was on the phone, she was a guy. So Mr. Kravitz, is your wife home? That's where she got the name Mr. Nancy. I know.
Okay.
But we clicked. I mean, we clicked so fast and like the songs came really quick. I mean, our creativity, everything, you know, came pretty fast.
Who did the writing?
A lot of it early on was Laura and Sally. And I kind of had to change my guitar style from freaky alien, a lot of pedals, very discordant stuff to, to bar chords. And melodic, you know, more melodic stuff. And I liked it.
Okay.
It was kind of a big change, you know. I liked it. I enjoyed it. I didn't know. I was unsure, like, where the band would head in the future. So, you know, we continued to write and stuff. We got another member temporarily in the band who actually went on to write a screenplay called Pray for Rock and Roll that starred Gina Gershon. And it's loosely based on members of Fabulous Disaster, FYI.
Sherry, what's her name?
Love Dog.
Love Dog.
Yes.
So she was in the band.
Yeah, for 6 months. She is on our very first album called Pretty Killers.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yep.
Let's sidebar for a quick second. Pray for Rock and Roll. What do you think of it?
I don't know if I've watched the whole thing. I think I caught
That's the review.
Yeah. I caught it at 3 a.m. one time, but we are in the soundtrack.
Are you?
Yeah. We're like in some bar scene. They play one of our songs on the jukebox.
The key thing I was really disappointed by it was that it was like a Lifetime movie about a chick rock band.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I've always found odd is that musicians can't make decent movies about being musicians for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
You think they would have it locked. They don't. The best movie that's not like this is Spinal Tap, you know, or something like this about being in a band is That Thing You Do.
I love it.
Written and directed by Tom Hanks. I have no idea, and I've never heard anyone explain how he was able to capture all of that.
Yeah.
I mean, as far as I know, he never played in a band or in school. So how does he nail that, whereas people who actually do it can't seem to get it right?
Right. Well,
that's just a weird thing. Did you see the TV series that they did as like on IFC or whatever when Gina Gershon was touring with Girls vs. Boys?
Yeah, I didn't.
To promote it.
A couple episodes, I think.
Yeah, I got it on DVD. I was cleaning out a Hollywood Video. And it's basically like this is Spinal Tap because she's going in to do interviews with people who hadn't seen the movie. The promotion's not there. She sounded great. She had a great Chrissy Hine type voice.
She had a great look.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
She's so hot. Mm-hmm. But yeah, just the movie itself was just kind of like, okay.
Mm-hmm. No. I know. Yeah.
Piece of music, but yeah, you know, stuff like that. Okay. Yeah. So Sherry Love Dog was in the band and then she left the band.
Yeah. And,
why'd she leave?
She lived kind of far away and, it just wasn't meshing, you know, with our style.
Okay.
So fast forward, Mr. Nancy's working at Bottom of the Hill, which is like the best club in San Francisco for live music. And in walks,
plug.
Yeah. And in walks, Fat Mike's wife, Erin. Fat Mike from NoFX and Fat Records. So Mr. Nancy hands her our first CD, Pretty Killers, which was put out on Evil Eye Records, sold out 1,000 copies.
Wow.
And, they called us the next week and said, we're very interested in you. We're going to, you know, assault you at your next show. Where are you playing? The whole Fat Records crew came out, saw us live at this shithole called The Tempest. In fact, Mike pretty much said, what are you doing next Tuesday? I want you in my office. Boom. We are signed to their subsidiary Pink and Black Records, which showcased more female-fronted punk bands.
So you're sent to the girl ghetto.
A little bit. But I'll tell you this much. Our music came out worldwide. We toured worldwide. That got me into the hearts and minds of many, many teenagers.
Okay, this band, this is 2001 now, right?
Yes, yeah.
So tell us about how did that feel and work compared to Inside Out's. So this is like a decade later now.
Yeah. So okay, I'm in my early 30s. I mean, I'm 6. And so, you know, basically right before, you know, we got signed to Fat Records, I was like, God, what is this band going to do? I was about ready to throw in the towel. You know, I wanted to pull a Robert Pollard. I'm like 32. I'm like, I think I might quit.
A who?
Robert Pollard from Guided by Voices.
Okay.
One of my favorites.
And what's the reference there?
Well, he was, you know, like, older at that time. He quit bands. He wasn't sure, like, you know, if this was going to work or whatever. He did a lot of indie stuff. And then, like, when he was older, he started to get the recognition, right? Which, you know, eluded him when he was younger. So we get signed in 2000, 2001. We go into Motor Studios in San Francisco with Ryan Green, who's a top-notch engineer dude, the best. And we release Put Out or Get Out. And to worldwide interest, we were on many Fat Records compilations with all the big boys, you know.
Who else was on Fat Records? And to be clear, it's Fat Wreck, like car wreck chords, like guitar chords, but it sounds like Fat Records.
Yeah, right. Let's see. Lagwagon, NOFX, No Use for a Name, a band called Tilt. Less Than Jake was on Fat Records.
Okay.
A lot of
bands that you'd think of as Warp Tour bands.
Yes. The boy bands. Yeah. Boy punk bands.
Okay.
So,
but not like the Green Day, Blink 182,
no.
You know, Sum 41.
No.
This is the real formula stuff, right?
Yeah. They have a formula, you know?
Okay.
Hence this started our touring. We toured the States. We toured many times. We toured Canada from the West to the East Coast. I did 10,000 miles in a month in a minivan.
Did you get like support from the label to pay for this?
Yes, we did get tour support, which is very unheard of these days. We got to rent a van, you know, for our first U.S. tour. We opened for Propaganda and Avail, who were also on Fat Records and J Church. That was our first big tour that got us out in front of a lot of people. He was very instrumental in getting us in getting our music out there. We went to Europe. We played the Deconstruction Festival. We were the first and only all-female band to play that. That's like the European Warp Tour. It's huge.
Okay.
We went to Japan. We got tour support. We opened for the Dickies. Played with so many bands, and that was what broke me. I mean, that got me, you know, out into, and our band, like, out into the public.
Okay.
You know? So
you're...
I used to get fan mail from Benji from Good Charlotte.
Really?
Yeah.
Still have it?
I don't think so.
Oh, come on.
I know. He loved us. And then they got really big, and I never heard from him again. But, but it was great.
Everyone's heard of Good Charlotte and Benji, and you're talking to me.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I'm going to fix that. This is going to blow you up, man. This is going to put you over the top.
All right. I hope so. Thanks, Dirk.
Now you remember.
Yeah. So, I mean, the experience was great. We followed it up with Panty Raid in 2003. Again, toured, you know, got the record out, got some royalties, you know.
Were you actually making a living as the band? Were you guys making a living as musicians, or was this just like at least covering the cost of being a musician? You
covering
still had
the
day
cost.
Jobs.
Covering the cost.
Okay. What were you doing for a day job?
Oh, I was, I worked for architects. I worked for lawyers. I was doing like, you know, like front desk stuff.
Okay.
You know,
you were a receptionist.
What?
It's honest
work. I was the face and the voice of, you know, some very nice, you know, Bay Area companies.
What do you want? I'm punk. I'm going on tour.
I just got a tattoo. Let me get out of here. So that was great. You know, it was, I owe Mike so much.
Did you ever tour Africa?
No.
Okay. So Europe, Japan, anywhere else in Asia?
No, Japan. We did a 10-day tour. We did all over Canada, the States. The most east I've ever been in Europe was Lithuania. The most west I've ever been in the world was Japan. I mean, it's great.
Technically, Japan's farther east.
Farther east, whatever. You know what I mean.
Okay, so, but, you know, you never, I'm trying to think of, what was, you never, you ever do Australia?
No, I have not. I would love to.
Okay.
Yeah.
After this interview goes out, you'll be in Australia.
Okay.
Only in Australia.
Right.
With the kangaroos. Okay, so you've done multiple things. Now, didn't the singer leave, Ebony?
Yes. What Laura left.
There?
Yep, Laura left in 2003. Just had a, I think she was done. She was kind of done touring and, you know, it was just getting harder and harder for her, and we wanted to keep going. And we weren't ready to quit yet. So, you know, we tried out some singers, and we, you know, stumbled upon one of my favorite singers, Cinder Block from Tilt. She was in the band for about 6 months, and then she quit. It just wasn't her cup of tea. So I took over lead vocals. We, you know, recruited a young guitar player and a young bass player. And
so were you still playing guitar, or just now you're just singing?
Just singing. I was fronting the band.
Okay.
And I wanted to keep these songs alive. I mean, the songs were great. We were still, Kathy, Sally and I were still writing. You know, we wrote stuff together. I was writing a lot lyrically. So, you know, we put out an independent EP with, I played bass on this, called I'm a Mess. 6-song EP that came out on Rodent Popsicle Records from the East Coast. but we still had the interest that we had from the Fat Records days, so we did a 2004 tour of Europe, which was very successful, and we were out for about 8 weeks.
Okay.
And
once again, why are you not a household name?
I know. We're more known in Europe, but whatever.
Okay.
So, you know, we had a great time. The band was great. We were really tight. You know, we're chugging along. It was awesome. One of our friends, fans, his name is Christian Kramer. He brought us over because he wanted us to play the Germany Berlin single speed race, show. And it's wildly popular in Germany. Like a bunch of people get together on their bikes, really drunk. And like race, and our song "Next Big Joyride" was the theme of this.
Okay.
And it brought a lot more fans. You know, like that. Really? It's a big deal. It's a big deal over there. Okay. Yeah. So we're like, okay, why not? So we did that. Came back. The bass player, she kind of left. She was going through some stuff. And at that time, you know, we already had another tour booked the year after, back to Europe. So we had to settle on getting a dude to fill in. And he went to Europe with us, hence pretty much the end of the band. After that, we recruited, we couldn't find any girl bass players in San Francisco. So we recruited a girl, Liz Velik from Brooklyn, who is a dear friend of mine to this day. So we got signed to kind of a metalish label. I can't remember what it is now. So they put out our last record called Love at First Fight.
Why weren't you still connected to Fat Records?
Pretty much after the lineup changed in 2003, you know, I don't think he, you know, he had the interest. Plus,
this ain't what I bought.
Yeah. And okay. Plus, like he, you know, he kind of let go of a lot of bands on the label. You know, it was kind of like they're more on an upswing now, but I think he was kind of, you know, minimizing the label more, I guess. Cleaning house a little bit. So he, like, you know, left the top four big drawing bands, and that's about it. Everybody else got the axe.
Sure.
So
business.
Yep. So, we recorded that in, like, 2007. Didn't tour behind it. We broke up shortly after that.
Okay, that's another decade down, more or less, so let's check out a couple tracks from Fabulous Disaster. And while you're listening to them, imagine how nice it would have been if Inside Out had the same recording treatment, okay? Kicking things off is a track that longtime listeners will probably recognize because they've played it at least once before. This is Gia off of their 2001 Put Out or Get Out album, Fabulous Disaster, featuring Linda Mandolin, who is our special guest on this special episode of Culture Vultures.
Kiss me. Fabulous, it's your life, don't shoot it.
You're listening to a special episode of Culture Vultures featuring the life and music of Linda Mandolin. That previous block kicked off with Gia by Fabulous Disaster. And after that was The Other Day from their 2003 album Panty Raid. And if you're getting a one of these things is seriously not like the other vibe from that last track, that's because it's Emulsion, with the song She Orbits off the album Sounding Rockets from 2002, which is explained like this.
So it was just a bedroom project my husband and I put out, and we did get some really good reviews from the CD called Sounding Rockets. We put it out on Evil Eye Records, and we basically just took, you know, like our top five like influences, and just, you know, kind of came up with, you know, experimental type, you know, more flowing music.
Okay,
you know. So, and we just, it was like a one-off thing.
Okay.
You know, we wanted to do something together and like, you know, something easy that we didn't play live, and Lickety Clit never played live either.
So it wasn't a band. It was a project.
Yes.
A recording project.
Yeah.
It's legitimate. It's honest work.
Yeah.
So now we have Girl Band.
Girl Band. Yes. I was still in, Fabulous Disaster when I heard of, well, I knew this girl, Shelly, in San Francisco, and my friend.
What year are we talking now?
Probably 2005.
Okay.
I'm still with Fabulous Disaster. I think Fabulous Disaster played a show with, well, the future of Girl Band. They were called the Decibels, you know, B-E-L-L-E-S. And that's where I met my dear friend, Krista DiBiase, who was the drummer. A girl named Erica, who I knew from another band, played bass. And then Shelly, my friend, played guitar. They, you know, they had some recordings. I was getting, you know, kind of friendly with Krista. And I'm like, man, you guys, like, jamming? You want to, like, do something? You need another guitar player? And they're like, oh, my God, Linda! So, like, they had, Shelly had some songs. I listened to them. I'm like, you know what? These are really cool. So I joined the band. We became Girl Band. Fabulous Disaster. A little jealous. But we recorded early on, like 3 weeks after I joined the band.
So is this overlapping with Fab D also?
Yes. So at one point I was in three bands.
So the project is, well, that's not a band, right? Or are you talking about three real bands or including Emulsion?
Well, no, it was, Fabulous Disaster, Girl Band, and Sassy, which will be next.
Okay.
Yeah.
So did your kind of like having a foot in another band contribute to Fabulous Disaster's, demise?
I think so.
So it's your fault.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was like I was messing around, you know. We were together for a long time.
Own it.
I do.
Okay.
I was messing around. But yeah, and we put out a record. It did pretty well, like, you know, underground standards. We got the dude that, you know, did all the cool RKL artwork, a guy named Dan Seitz, to do the cover art. And I really had fun in Girl Band. We had a really good cult following in San Francisco.
Why the name Girl Band? Just being ironic. It was an all-girl band, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That was Shelly's idea. We wrote this one in the bathroom. It's about anal sex. Stuff like that, you know?
Really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, let's give these girls some shots. Yeah. That was about it.
Okay.
Yep. Hey, man. Free booze.
It's legit. All right. So then Sassy.
Sassy, yeah. Sassy kind of formed out a girl band. I just really wanted to play in a two-piece band, and I really wanted to play with Krista, the drummer.
Okay.
I had a bunch of ideas. We jammed quite a bit. We did a lot of, you know, writing together. And
so what year are we talking now?
Our first show was 2007. So 2006, you know, like right around that time. Okay. Fab D was still together, probably just got back from tour. We started, you know, jamming and stuff, getting our look together. So we played some great shows. Our second show was opening for the Donnas in Long Beach.
Okay.
That got us out to a lot of people. We dressed, we wore like matching, you know, sexy outfits. I played through a Marshall and a bass amp, you know, with the splitter. So,
okay.
You know, I had the heavy guitar sound going. It sounded like a four-piece band, you know, and
okay.
We both did harmonies.
Sure. Now, here's the obvious question, though. This is 2006, 2007.
Mm-hmm.
This is post-White Stripes. Any two-piece band.
I love the White Stripes.
But two-piece bands, Black Keys, you know, you know, this, did you ever get the, oh, you're trying to be all female White Stripes?
Yeah. Or they're like, do you need a bass player? You know, it's like, no. No, we covered a White Stripes song on our first album. I adored them. Let's Build a Home. So yeah. And we did really good. We put out two records. We were, we had a, what do you call it? What's a promotion company that sends out your CD? We had a publicist. We had a good publicist. I can't think. It's getting late.
Yeah.
We did really, really well. We did a small, tour of the West Coast. We didn't get over to Europe. But you know, we had a blast. It was like the most funnest band I've ever been in, you know,
of all of them.
One of them. Yeah. Okay. I mean, we clicked so good. And you know, it's like if you're hungover the next day and you can't make it to band practice, you know, you only got one person to call. You know what I mean? Like, it's can't make it, girl. All right, I hear you. You know, like stuff like that. But yeah, it was a blast.
Okay. Yeah. But what happened with that?
Well, 2011 rolled around and my mom got really sick.
Okay.
And I came back here. She passed away in March of 2011. Krista had met this guy named Mike Cloward, and he was a drummer. He was looking to get back into a band. And so they were talking, and they wanted to form a new band. And I'm like, geez, can I handle this? I mean, I'm happy with Sassy. My mom just passed away. I don't know what to do. We jammed with this other bass player. He didn't work out, so we recruited our friend Erica, who was in girl band, into our new band, Sorry Ever After. And after my mom passed away, my creative mojo just went through the roof. And I recorded in one, I wrote 17 songs in 1 year.
Really?
Yeah. And they were good. Yeah.
So you write 17 songs in a year. Is that like a heavy production? I mean, some people would be like, that's what I wrote in 2 weeks or a week or whatever.
For me. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And so we did a EP on Blue Vinyl. We did get a distribution deal. And then we went to Tim Green's studio. He's a pretty famous producer. He's in Grass Valley, California. He used to be in a band called, Nation of Ulysses. He was in, The Fucking Champs. And he's done a bunch of people from the Melvins to, it runs the gamut. I mean, he's done tons of folks.
Okay.
So we went in there, recorded this whole album. In 2012, the band implodes and I moved to Maine.
Why did the band implode?
I don't know. I think it was just too much for me at that time. I kind of had a little falling out with my friend of many years, and it was really, hard. It was hard to deal with. It was very emotional and a lot of turmoil with, you know, coming to grips with the death of my own mom and, having to deal with, turmoil in a band. I was just like, God, I'm over this, you know. And we had gotten a lot of great press, really good shows in San Francisco. We were starting to play like really good clubs.
Yeah, you had a video for Honey Girl.
Yeah.
How was that shot?
Well, this guy named Blair, he knew Mike.
You were like playing multiple roles in it, weren't you? Is that what was going on with that?
Yeah,
it's
like
been a while since I've seen that.
Yeah, and he kind of made it where you know, we were dressed differently. And he would multiply us, you know, like make clones of us in like different outfits, sure, watching us play.
Right.
I thought that was really neat. And that was shot on top of Mike's apartment building in downtown Oakland.
Okay.
And it was a beautiful day. And like, oh my God, I got home from that shoot and I just collapsed. I was like, oh, I'm so tired. But he did a great job, you know.
Did you ever do videos for any of your other bands?
We did a Fabulous Disaster video for Next Big Joyride with Cinder singing. And it was the original song that Laura had sang on, so it was kind of weird.
Okay.
But I did see the original, or the, you know, the final production, but it never got released.
Really? So it's not like on YouTube anywhere or something?
No.
Like that?
Mm-mm.
How odd.
I know, and it's great. We all look great. Sally has full makeup on. I mean, it looks awesome.
Is this like notable for a reason?
Yeah. Courtney Love called her Power Dyke.
Now, did you guys know Courtney Love or associate with her?
Oh, I had a great...
She came over looking for drugs.
I had a great day with her.
Really?
I had a very famous... In a nutshell. Yeah.
Okay, that's a tease. The Courtney Love story is a hoot, so stick around after this block of tunes. Let's cover the bands we were just talking about. This is a triple play. First off, it'll be Girl Band with I'm the One, and then after that, it'll be Sassy and Sorry Ever After. We are the Culture Vultures, and this is a special episode with the life and music of Linda Mandolin.
Thank you.
girl, how did you know that your life would change? You couldn't let him go. Honey girl, come on, come on. Time to break out of your shell and move it on. Look
Honey Girl by Sorry Ever After, off their 2012 album, Meet Us Where the Lights Are Low. We talked about the video. It was a super cool video. Unfortunately, it's no longer online. Apparently, the director took it down and you can't see it, but it was super cool. If you do go to the Sorry Ever After website, there is a B-roll of they're shooting it, but the actual video itself is kerplunk, just like everything else. Before that was Sassy. That's with 3 exclamation points with So Bad It's Good off of their 2010 album Digging Deep. And kicking off that block was I'm the One by Girl Band. Okay, well, we've teased it long enough. Let's talk about when Linda met Courtney.
She was at the Oakland airport and I was picking up April Fresh, who was our bass player in 2004. And April lived in Long Beach. I had April's bass, and I see this woman. I look over at the payphone. I'm like, that's Courtney Love. And so, we pass her, and, I didn't know what to say. And she goes, hey, girls. So she called us over, and I'm like, oh, my God. Hi, Courtney, And she's like, I want to go where you go. And she was stroking my braids and everything. And I'm like, I don't know. My husband doesn't really like you.
really?
Yeah. So
had you encountered her before, or is it just like a weird? Did she know who
random.
Did she know who you were?
No.
She just saw girls with guitars.
Yeah, and wanted to come with us. Yeah, that's how she rolls. So
hold on. So you could have hung out with Courtney Love, except
I did hang out with Courtney Love.
Except okay, but then the Mister doesn't like her.
Well, no, I mean we'd always bad mouth her. We're like, yeah, she blah blah blah. But then I got to spend time with her. She came in my car, took her back to the hotel. We went up to her room. She was naked in 5 minutes. I tuned her guitar.
What? Oh my gosh, it's great.
Yeah. And, she, we went down to the hotel, gift shop. She bought a whole bunch of stuff, gave me all this stuff. I'm like, Courtney, no, you don't have to buy me anything. She goes, it's on Virgin. Don't worry about it. It's on Virgin Records tab. And so she calls up. We went back up to the hotel room. At this point, Sally, the drummer, she joins us. So there's 3 of us with Courtney hanging out. She calls up Urban Outfitters pretending to be me and says, hi, this is Linda. My friend Courtney Love's in town. Will you keep the store open late? They said yes. So we take a taxi down there. She forces me to air guitar to Journey on a stack of carpets in the middle of the store. People got pictures, but I never saw the photos. This is 2004, four, so I think.
It's pretty decent cell phone camera.
Yes, yeah. She tries on a bunch of clothes, rips up the coats.
It's convenient that there's no actual visual proof of this event.
I know, yeah.
But you're not making this up, right?
No, not at all, no. So she gets hungry at one point. I'm like, Courtney, you want some food? I'll go across. Do you want like a Whopper? She goes, yeah. So like I go across the street.
Does she really talk like that?
Yeah, kind of. Okay. And got her a Whopper. She like ate this greasy Whopper on the floor, like digging through her clothes. She gives me $800 cash to hold on to. She wants to buy me like all this stuff. And I'm like, no, you don't have to do that. She goes, I was never good with Kurt's money. She ends up buying a bunch of stuff for her and I. We go back to the hotel. She goes, here, Linda, here's your panties pile. You know, bought me a bunch of underwear stuff, all this stuff. And at the end, you know, we had a great day. I had a wonderful day with her, Pete. And she said, Linda, it feels like I've known you for 3,000 years. And we clicked, you know, and I said, can I send you like some fabulous disaster stuff? She's like, yes. And she, you know, gave me her management company, the phone number, everything. She gave me a kiss, you know, like when I left. And
was it just two of you, or was there this other person? April Fresh?
Yeah, April.
Was she long for this ride, or it's just you two?
I think right at the end it was us two. But okay. The other girls were there. I think they left at some point. But
okay.
But her and I hung out.
The thing was Serge waiting for you, or did you call him like, listen, I'm hanging out with Courtney Love?
No, she called him and talked to him. And she also called Karen Queen Bee.
So how did those calls go?
She's like, hey, what's going on? This is Courtney Love. You know, and they're like, what? Like, they couldn't believe it.
Wow.
It was awesome. It was like one of the best days. I could write like a short little book on it, you know.
You should.
I know.
You should. You know, it's almost, you know, this is a short indie movie in the making.
My day with Courtney Love.
And have Karen play her. I'll do that. Next time you come back into town, we'll shoot it. It'll be awesome.
Okay.
We'll work on it. Okay.
That'd be great. And I'll play myself. Anyway.
No. You're going to play Courtney. She's going to play you.
Right. There you go.
Irony.
I know. So it was great.
So hold on. What happens when you get home? What does the mister say about
this? He couldn't believe it. He's like, oh my God. And I said, you know, my opinion of her like totally changed, but I could see if you weren't in her good graces, I kind of saw how she treated the hotel staff and like other people.
Oh, she nasty to the help?
A little bit.
Yeah, that's not cool.
I know. And she told me this crazy story where she was like, you know, just overnight in Oakland because someone was trying to kill her in L.A. and she was flying to Hawaii to, like, get away. It was crazy. Yeah, it was pretty crazy.
Dave Grohl.
Right? So
okay. Wow.
I know.
Thanks for that digression.
But it was great.
So Sorry Ever After implodes.
Yep, that's 2012. I moved to Maine.
Why?
We wanted a different way of life. Serge did really, really well with his job, Zynga. He didn't want to do the commute anymore. And then his dad lives in Maine. He's from Maine. And his dad is our only parent we have left between us.
Okay.
So we kind of wanted to be closer to him. We'd gone on vacation in 2012, found a house, bought the house, and moved in November of 2012.
Okay.
Whereas I was so distraught, I quit music.
Really?
Or, yeah.
From the move or just from the bands breaking up or just...
Bands and just bullshit in general. I think I had had enough. 6 months later, I get the itch and I record Wild Butterfly tunes.
Okay.
And that is specifically a studio band. And released...
Adeline,
Glorious, and Silver Day. So I have three singles out on Bandcamp. And
what's the status of Evil Eye? Or have you like
Evil Eye's done?
Okay, so you shut down the record label.
Shut down the record label. And so,
okay, the thing is you've transitioned through music from the zine, sending out cassette tape, flyering thing, through the earliest days of the internet, and that sales and that sort of promotion to now. No one has a record label. You're selling tracks through Bandcamp or iTunes or whatever methods you used.
Mm-hmm.
How has that either been better, worse, different? What are your thoughts on the changes?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's being an independent musician, it's going to be hard making money, you know, at all. So at this point, you know, at this stage in my life, you know, I'm just happy to, you know, like record music and put it out. You know, I have fans. I still have fans. I have people writing me daily, you know, be it from Fabulous Disaster or Inside Out or Wild Butterflies or whatever, you know, and I know I've made an impact to some people or to, you know,
have you ever gotten a letter? I saw you with Fabulous Disaster and I started a band.
Yes.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Anyone who's gone on to do anything or just, you know?
Well, yeah, mostly just, you know, fans, a lot of girls. Okay. I've seen, you know, bands cover Fabulous Disaster songs, like
really?
Brazilian bands. Yep. We actually got really big down there, but we were in all the magazines, but we never toured down there. L7 is huge down there. They love female rock bands. They go crazy. I still get fan mail every day. Come play Brazil. Come to South America.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. So
that's odd.
I don't know. Yeah, we just, you know, got known down there, like through all the magazines.
And so after Wild Butterflies, then and then when we did this original interview, you had already prepped up, you booked up a tour. You're going to do a Fabulous Disaster reunion tour.
Yes.
For early 2014.
Yeah.
Well, now it's 2015. So yeah. How'd that tour go? How'd that come together? And what do you have to say about that?
There was a booker in Germany who was a big fan. His name's Benny. And he wanted to bring us over. He begged us for like 2 years. We're like, oh, God, I don't know. I don't know if we can do it. But he begged and pleaded. And Sally, you know, she dealt with a lot of the back and forth, which helped. And we booked a tour. We kind of flew into Kiel, Germany, where Benny's based out of. We rehearsed for 4 days straight after not seeing each other for a long time. And
yeah, because you didn't like get together in San Francisco.
Nope.
Did you? So basically, this is all put together, you know, on the phone, and then you flew over there and you did 4 days of rehearsal.
Yeah.
Wow.
And we were just tight as ever, and so our first show was in Berlin, and you know, we did I think 17 days straight without a break, so every night.
I remember seeing the schedule. I was like, wow, that's going to be
brutal. It was brutal for like our age group, so. It was hard.
Because let's fess up. So how old is everybody now?
40s.
Yeah, you're in 40s. Okay, well, she may be getting older. She's definitely not slowing down, as we'll hear, beginning with Tiger Bomb, which is a goof on the Tiger Balm cream.
Yeah, so Tiger Bomb moved out to Maine, quit music, kind of picked back up, did the Wild Butterflies thing, but I'm like, you know, I'm itching to do like another female band again. So I had always heard of this band, this girl band from Maine called The Brood, and I wanted to find out more about them and find out what the members were doing or whatever. This fan on Facebook, you know, he lived in Portland, and he's like, you know, will you play with me? And I'm like, nah, you know, I'm kind of looking for female musicians. Okay, I'll try to set you up. So the first girl didn't work out. The second girl didn't work out. The third girl, he's like, third time's a charm. Chris Horn from The Brood. I'm like, you know a girl from The Brood? Yeah, blah, blah, blah. You should meet. So we met, we played, we clicked. Like my twin. We clicked. We each have our own songs, but together they fit. I mean, they sound great together. So we found a bass player named Andrea, and then we picked up a great drummer in Portland. Her name's Cindy. And we've been playing since, I think, 2013, but we recorded a whole album. We got to get it mastered. and put it out, but we have some label interest, but we'll see.
How are you going to put it out? Well, it depends on the labels. Who's
label?
Okay, label.
Get Hip and Dionysus. It's like a garage rock label.
Okay.
We're more like in the garage rock scene now.
Is anybody, gosh, I actually veered off the, continue on.
So. Okay. Yeah. So, we're at that point. We got a full, you know, full record in the can, just trying to figure out what to do. Playing shows, and then my engineer from Tiger Bomb approached me, and he said he wanted to form a band with me. And this guy is like a musical prodigy of Portland and Maine. He's amazing. He's one of the most amazing musicians I've ever played with.
Does he have a name?
Todd Hutchison.
Does he have a last name? Todd
Hutchison. Yeah.
Okay.
And he's brilliant. He's got tons of pedals. He's got cool guitars. He owns a studio in Portland.
He's the dream man.
He's the dream man. And so he's like, wow, I have this, like, you know, this rhythm section that could eat our stuff for lunch. Let's, you know, like, let's get together and stuff. And so we've been jamming for months, you know, some months, and we're going to be playing out soon, but we don't have a name yet. So we're a 4-piece shoegaze band, all original, lots of effects.
What would you compare it to stylistically wise? Are you back in Lumer territory?
Bloody Valentine. Yeah.
So you're getting
sonic.
You're getting you're getting your Kevin Shields rocks off.
Yes, very much.
Yeah.
Hey, it's back. It's back with a vengeance. All those shoegaze bands are reforming and touring.
Now, we don't have any music yet from this unnamed band, but let's sample a couple of tunes from the other two bands we'd covered in this last passage, Tiger Mom, but first, Wild Butterflies with Adeline. This was their self-released tune from 2013. This is the Culture Vultures special episode with Linda Mandolin.
Come in waves.
My, isn't that some tasty, sweet, crunchy music? That's Tiger Bomb with Don't Forget the Girl. Before that, Wild Butterflies with Adeline. As we were winding down our conversation, we started talking about some various odds and ends and topics, and including something that's somewhat unavoidable when you're covering female musicians playing in what is predominantly a boys' sandbox, namely sexism. I asked Linda if they found it to be a factor or not a factor, a benefit or a detriment.
Some ways it's been a factor, in other ways not so much. Just, you know, trying to think back to the Inside Out days. I think it was such a different scene back then. It was like, everything was just like, you know, kind of meshing together, be it like punk, metal, all kinds of stuff, jazz, whatever. I don't remember getting that, you know, you're good for a girl. Well, I think I got it once at the Hamtramck pub, but like, we didn't really get that. You know, people are like, you guys are a great band. You guys are a great band. Fast forward to Fabulous Disaster, being on, you know, a label with all these dudes, it's like, okay, you're going to put us on this, you know, female-focused label. And when Warped Tour came around, they wanted to put us, not our label, but the Warped Tour people wanted to make, you know, like this ladies' lounge thing. And our boss is like, no, no, no. They can bat with the big boys, okay? You know, so yeah, we kind of got it with Fabulous Disaster a little bit, but I don't know. Just kind of brushed it off. Yeah, I know.
Okay. But I mean,
we knew we were a good band. We knew we were a great band.
Okay. No, but I'm just saying it's like, you know, were there any, ever have any problems with clubs or promoters like, hey, girls, or anything like that?
Little bit. Yeah, there was this weird guy in Italy. We ended up spanking his ass in the bathroom, but that's another story.
That you're not going to share with the class?
No.
This doesn't sound like a bad story, at least from his viewpoint. I'm starting to think that maybe this is what he was going for. Okay, moving on. Do you think you would have made it farther or if you had stayed in Detroit? Or getting out of town was like the key to everything?
I think I made the right decision. I really did. I mean, I found my destiny in San Francisco, you know, and I think it was just time for me to go. And I know that, you know, I kind of missed out on the, you know, the whole like Detroit rock revival with the White Stripes and blah, blah, blah. But I'm thinking, you know, the music I was doing, you know, I don't think it really fit that garage, you know, kind of style. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So, no, I think I made the right decision. And, you know, I've done a lot more than your average Joe, put it that way.
Or Jane.
Know? Or Jane, yeah. Joe and Jane.
Thing I forgot when we were talking about Inside Out, and I know we discussed it before. Was there ever any clashing between pop and punk purity between you and Karen? I've always heard that it was kind of like, you know, you were more poppy, and she was like, no, we got to be punk, and you know, get that pop music out of here. So was that
Karen was also very poppy. Karen had her very pop moments, brilliantly pop moments, like Love Letter Bomb. That's her song.
Okay.
You know, very, that could have been very commercial. You know, it just didn't get in the right hands. Yeah, we would, you know, we had some differences, you know, but
that's what I was trying to touch on earlier when we were,
so young. We were really young.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, cause you're talking about how everything was so easy and like a hive mind, but obviously there started to be, everybody started to manifest as individuals, you know, they started to disconnect from the collective and then the trouble started.
Right.
Reunion. I forgot to talk about that. So how did that come about? How did you guys prep up for that? And
how
did the show go?
It was so good. It was just great. I don't know. We were talking and we're like, oh yeah, we should do this, blah, blah, blah. And at
you were still in San Francisco at the time, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I would like fly out for, you know, some rehearsal. Those guys would get together a couple times, like just rhythm section,
right?
And play. And so I came
out.
How
long had it been since you guys had last played?
1994. Live. Okay. So almost 20 years.
So it had been 18?
Yeah, 18 years. Yeah.
Okay.
And we came back. We got a lot of great press out of it, you know. You know, Karen pulled a lot of strings with her connections and the, you know, her, she got a lot of great press with Queen Bee and stuff. And, you know, a lot of people remembered us and really, you know, looked up to us. And the Metro Times did a really interesting article on where are they now. It was a few years ago, like influential bands, and Inside Out was mentioned in that. So, you know, and again, we got like really great press leading up to the show. We decided on Smalls. and Melody, and they're awesome over there. And it was a great show. It was just so electric. It was like no time had passed.
That's what really impressed me about it, because, and I was talking to my girlfriend, Hermione.
Yes.
and I just thought, it's like, here we have three women who are now in their 40s. Okay. These are women old enough to be the parents of young bands that are starting now, and you would flatten them like, you know, kicking over sandcastles at a beach. You guys, you guys wailed. It wasn't like somebody who does a band for children now that we will not discuss.
No.
Still remember that thing at the Hamtramck pub.
Anyway.
That's a story. That was in the last interview. But we're not going to tell that one now. So, anyway, the thing is I thought to myself, it's like, wow, you know, and the thing is we've noticed this in bands in general from that era.
Yeah.
You know, they're like, you know, the Buzzcocks are all pushing 60 and they still throw it down. And, you know, other bands, you know, Cheap Trick, and, you know, they still come out and they put on a great show. And it's just kind of weird. I'm sure you've seen lots of newer bands.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find there's something different in like kind of the stage work ethic, or is it just like basically per band, some bands work it and some don't?
Yeah. I think it depends on the band. You know, there's like some crazy sonically good bands out there. I know they've been around for a little while, but they're a band called the Fleshies, and they would just rip your friggin' head off. I mean, they're so good. They're out of Oakland, California. And I've seen a lot of, you know, younger bands, you know, it depends. If they have it, you know, they have it.
Sure.
You know, like, you know, I've seen a lot of a passion in younger bands. One band, well, they've been together for a while now, The Gossip. I mean, they came out of Poor Kids out of Arkansas, and they just made their own niche. You know, like they, you know, they weren't country. They weren't, you know, like shitty music. They were so innovative. But yeah, I notice a difference, you know, like, I don't know. It doesn't seem like it was in the 80s and 90s, you know?
Do you think that's because we've moved? The thing is, everyone blamed MTV for killing musicianship and stuff like this. And then every 10 years, something else comes along that's to blame for the downfall of good music, as, you know, determined by grumpy old people or hipsters, right? But the thing is that now that we've gone, it's been 30 years since MTV, and MTV isn't even MTV anymore.
No.
Okay. And, you know, we're 15 years past boy bands and Britney Spears, and, you know, we've moved
on
to.
Thank God.
Well, no, but I mean, then nowadays we have Rihanna and One Direction. It's like a cyclical thing. Every 10 years, New Kids on the Block, NSYNC, One Direction. Every 10 years, something else will come along that is going to horrify everybody. Then they will go on. And then in another 10 years, like cicadas, something else will come out and do this.
Right.
However, you know, with the difference in, you know, the way networking, for example, if the technology that we have today of FaceSpace and, you know, Bandcamp and SoundCloud and all the other stuff, if Inside Out had those tools 30 years ago, what would have been different, if anything?
Dirk.
Say what you're going to say.
Mr. Dirk. Yeah, I don't know. You know, it's hard to pinpoint because we didn't grow up with that technology, you know. I'm kind of glad we didn't. I'm glad that we, you know, had the cassette tapes, you know, had the cassette tapes in our cars, you know, like sent, you know, tapes off to labels or friends or made the mixtape, you know. It's great now. I kind of like it better now that I'm older. I don't know if I would appreciate it as much. It would be too weird for me, I think, if I was younger. Does that make any sense?
No,
I don't know.
Not at all.
I don't know. I guess what I'm trying to say is I am like so glad that I grew up when I did. And I didn't have like all this like technology. I was the first wave of like all the video games, you know, like the primitive video games that came out, and
sure,
and you know, I talked on the phone to my friends and I played outside, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
So
it's kind of like, were the limitations of the time, you know, what I want to say, were you freed by the limitations, you know, because you didn't have a bazillion options, you were just forced to like, okay, I've got these rudimentary tools and whatnot. Okay.
Yeah. I think so.
Bikini Kill is credited as launching the Riot Girl movement. There's a documentary or something that came out a couple of years ago.
I saw it.
There were some features, the punk singer, stuff like that. And just the whole, you know, Riot Girl. But the thing is that their first album came out in 92 when you guys were basically shuffling toward the end of Inside Out.
Yeah.
So once again, I have to ask, why does everyone think history started with them when it didn't?
Right. Well, I think it should have started with a band called Frightwig, and Frightwig is one of my biggest influences of all time. They came before Inside Out did.
Really?
It came in 84. Yeah. They're from San Francisco. They were a three-piece female band. Their first album was called Cat Farm Faboo. If you look at the Nirvana Unplugged and you see the shirt that Kurt Cobain is wearing, he's wearing a Frightwig t-shirt.
Oh, really?
So that helped them in a lot of ways. They just reformed recently, but they influenced me so much.
How do we miss this earlier?
I don't know. We talked about a lot of stuff, but I didn't, you know, I was already forming a band and, you know, in a band by the time I formed, by the time I heard Frightwig. So they're kind of like my peers, sort of, a little bit older than me. And Mia, the guitar player in Frightwig, she filled in for Mr. Nancy for a Fabulous Disaster tour. So she was actually a member of Fabulous Disaster at one point before we got signed to Fat Records. And she's like one of my idols. Anyway, so this Bikini Kill thing that came out in 92, bands like Inside Out and, you know, Frightwig predated that. So I never really got the Riot Girl thing, you know, and I don't think musically they were all that great.
Okay.
So, and that really wasn't my scene. You know, I was already toured, you know, I already had my identity. You know, I didn't really identify with that scene too much.
Because was it because there was more of a political angle to that kind of music?
I don't know. I just it wasn't something I was listening to. I was listening to like No Means No and you know, like I said, getting into more shoegazy bands and more pop stuff. So I really didn't pay attention to that scene, you know. I think now I hear about Bikini Kill more nowadays, now that it's kind of like a throwback, you know. But back then, I really didn't have an interest in it, so I can't really comment that much.
Back to Peel Sessions, I have a note here. How did you snag two Peel Sessions? We talked about one, but what
well, we
was
did
the second one.
We just did one.
Why do I have a note that you have two here?
No. Okay. I think we were asked, but it didn't materialize because we didn't come back a third time.
Ah, okay. If you'd gone back a third time, you would have done a second one?
Yes.
And still been unknown.
Maybe.
Okay, now we're in the home stretch here, and this is something that we invented on the very first episode of Culture Vultures. This is what we call the Deep Thoughts Musicians Quiz Game. Every musician interview is always the same thing. What are your influences? How did you start? And in this case, we've actually had that discussion already. But usually when we have bands in, we run this by them, a kind of a non-standard Q&A. It goes a little something like this. First question, when did you realize that you had enough aptitude at music to become a creator rather than just a player?
Creator. I don't know. It was kind of early on when I you know, when I was taking lessons and stuff, I'm like, oh, that's good. He's like teaching me the basics. He's teaching me, you know, how to play other people's songs. But I was starting to create on my own. So I think around age 15, you know, I was like, fuck this. I can like, you know, I can do it myself. So I started creating at an early age.
Okay.
You know?
If you could sing or play like anyone, who would it be and why?
Myself. No, I don't know. sing and play like anyone. I don't know, man. I really like that St. Vitus chick.
St. Vincent.
Oh, it's St. See, I told you I'm losing
I'm leaving that in. Okay. What song do you wish you had written and why?
I love, one of my favorite songs of all time is I Want You, She's So Heavy by the Beatles. That is like one of the best riffs.
Why? Is that just like the riff?
I love the riff. I love the lyrics. I love the feeling in his voice. It's probably my favorite Beatles tune too.
Okay. Mm. Is there a specific lyric or verse that you find so clever, brilliant, insightful, emotional, or wish you had written?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I love
like a great quotable line.
Yeah.
Something for the yearbook.
I don't know, man. I love Morrissey's lyrics. I mean, I think he's so clever and he's so like backhanded.
I'm sorry you mispronounced Paul Westerberg there.
Next.
Morrissey? Really?
Oh, I love Morrissey.
Stuff is grocery list.
Oh, come on. He's deep.
Is songwriting easier? No, it's not. Is songwriting easier or hard for you?
Sometimes it's really easy. Sometimes it's very hard. I've recently kind of been in like a funk. I've been writing a lot of lyrics, but musically I'm falling off a little bit nowadays, but I'm still getting a lot of inspiration. I don't know. It comes in, bursts of creativity. I think that's a lot, you know, that's typical with any artist. You go through like a dry spell, you know, you're like, oh my God, I'm all washed up. And then like, boom, like, you know, like the coolest thing happens. So.
Okay. If you could switch over to any other style or genre of music, regardless of whether you had any competence at it or not, what would you do and why?
R&B.
R&B?
Yeah, because I don't know.
What kind of R&B? Let's specify.
I was raised on like the early, you know, Motown stuff and like Stax Records and, you know, singers like Laura Lee and Denise LaSalle, like the down and dirty, you know, like just, you know, soul root kind of thing. And I don't know, I just it's been a passion of mine, you know, and I love singing soulfully. I think I can pull it off.
Okay. This is the one everyone gets hung up on: awards, fame, or money, which means critical acclaim, general popularity, or financial riches. Pick two and explain why you didn't take the third. So you can be famous, acclaimed, or rich. Pick two of those. Okay, that are the most important to you. And explain why you didn't take the third one.
Okay, let's see. Maybe famous? More famous than I am? I don't know. I think the bands I've been in, like, didn't, you know, get their just reward.
Okay, so you're not famous?
Yeah. And what was the other one?
Money or acclaim?
Acclaim, because, I don't know. Again, I think, you know.
So you want more acclaim? You want more fame? You want to be critically acclaimed?
Yes.
So why didn't you take the money?
Because I'm doing really well. Money wise,
you're the worst person in the world. You know that. You're basically telling girls get a guitar and find a rich husband.
Oh no, no, no! He wasn't rich when I met him. Trust me.
Find the guy who gets rich.
And girl, now come on! It was a collaborative effort.
Sure.
Yes.
Okay, you are wrathful music god. End someone's career for their sins against music and explain why.
Oh gosh, that's not going to be hard. Let's see. Creed, Nickelback, Jesus, Sammy Hagar. Come on, man.
are these supposed to be self-evident?
Ooh. And you know what I heard recently that was really bad? Love Beach by Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. Get the fuck out of here. That is so bad. That is so fucking bad. It's so nasty. Come on.
Okay. You are now merciful music god. Make someone you think has been unfairly overlooked famous and explain why.
Overlooked famous and explain why. Oh, Dexter Romweber. Dexter Romweber Duo. He used to be a member.
That's active, right?
No, the flat Duo Jets.
Oh, okay. Oh, that Sarah Romweber is the one.
Yes.
That's active.
That's her.
Are they related?
Yeah, they're brother and sister.
Ah.
So they play together. She plays drums. He plays guitar. He is one of the most passionate artists I have ever seen, and he should be way, 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 way bigger than he is. He's done duets with Cat Power. Oh, God, who's the other girl? Nico Case.
Okay.
You know, big band, you know, big acts, big names like that, and he still hasn't got his just dues. And he's like the modern day Elvis, but weird, you know.
It's funny that you consider Nico Case and Cat Power to be big names because they're
not. Kinda, really?
They did well. They're big in the small world. Okay.
Well, they did well.
They're sitting at the head of the kitty table.
Okay. Whatever. It's not baby metal, okay?
I know. But, hey, don't. They'll eventually be old enough to look at without feeling bad about myself.
Okay.
What's your rock band, Guitar Hero band name? What's a weird, funny name? The thing is, you've already had the funny names.
Oh, yes.
But if you
one of my favorites of all time, Adrian Skullfuck and the Eye Sockets.
And how is Adrian spelled?
A-D-R-I-A-N.
Okay, so it's the male Adrian, not Adrienne. Like, you know, right. Like, okay.
But that's clever.
Okay. Whatever you want. This is your... While we were all betting
okay, Adrienne.
On it,
yeah.
No. You've already said Adrienne. Okay. And finally, when your entry in the Encyclopedia of Music is written, what is the most important thing you want to be said or remembered about you and your music?
That she wrote great songs.
That's all? She wrote great songs?
Mm-hmm.
Anything else that we should mention about you that you would like to tell us before we wrap things up?
Let's see, I'm an Aries. I like cats. I enjoy wine and long walks on the beach.
So this is your Tinder profile?
Tiger Beat questions. I'm 5'6" and green eyes, black hair, dark brown hair. And yeah, I like rock and roll. This is Linda Mandolin signing off. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for talking to us, Linda. Linda Mandolin, a very special episode of Culture Vultures. Next week, Otto will be back, and we'll be back to our usual hijinks, committing random access talk, talking about movies, television, comic books, video games, pop nerd media culture stuff. If you'd like to hear what else we do, if you're a newcomer, culturevulturesradio.com. Take it a look. See what you like. Subscribe to us through iTunes and Stitcher. You can follow us on Twitter. You can come to the Facebase page. Give us a like. As I mentioned at the top of the show, this was a passion project of mine. We tried to record this in July or so, 2013, but there were some technical problems, and I didn't like the way it turned out, so I scrapped it. Then in July 2015, she was back in town, and we recorded the interview conversation that we have just listened to. I hope you enjoyed this format. It's a lot of work to put together, I'll say that much, especially when you're trying to balance out... 30 years of a life and 15 songs from 10 different bands. And believe it or not, this isn't everything that we could have gone with. I was just trying to keep it under a tidy 12 hours. Anyway, once again, Culture Vultures is a production of Dirk Omnimedia. Copyright 2015, but you know, if you pass it around, I won't tell. The show is created, produced, engineered, hosted by me, Peter Shorn. I play the role of Dirk Belligerent. Otto the Autopilot is played by Chris Smith, but he's not here, so we shouldn't even be talking about him. Our guest this week was Linda Mandolin, and I know her real name. And it rhymes with the team that lost to the Royals this year. Hint, hint. Anyway, our website, once again, is Culture Vultures Radio. That's culturevulturesradio.com. We broadcast live first at Diffuse Radio. That's diffuseradionetwork.com in Detroit at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Friday nights. If you'd like to hear this music that's in the background, this is Def Ref. The song's called Caper, and you can get a clean copy of that downloaded from culturevulturesradio.com. Anyway, I think that's turned out pretty well. And if you disagree, send us an email, and we'll talk about it in a future episode. Once again, many, many thanks to Linda. Thank you for being a friend. Thank you for just being you. And thanks for the music, as ABBA would say. Okay. Anyway, next week, back to business as usual. You all be safe out there. Good night.